You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, you are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. Many thanks to Neil and Julie for the past 2 hours. As always, a rather hard act to follow it, but follow it we must. So, for the next 60 minutes, we'll be engaging in a song and dance over the latest cinema releases. Which new movies have us tripping the light fantastic, and which keep treading on our toes with their clumsy two left feet? My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in the studio today are Emma Marchant.
Hello.
Sarah McIntosh.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Hello.
And Owen Baker.
Hello.
Today's show hopes to offer both style and a little substance. Though it's dressed to the nines, Wes Anderson's opulent The Grand Budapest Hotel is more concerned with the knowledge that all things must pass. Action movie Need for Speed is for people who think the Fast and Furious films aren't nearly fast enough. And director Jonathan Glazer offers an eerie view of the human race through the eyes of a predatory alien played by Scarlett Johansson in the science fiction fever dream Under the Skin. We also look forward to this week's special arts picture house screening of the low-budget British comedy Dead Cat, with an interview with its director Stefan Giorgio. And we have the first report from last weekend's Watersprite Cambridge International Student Film Festival, a short talk with Roger Grafe, the filmmaker responsible for such vital documentaries as the BAFTA-winning Police and the groundbreaking prison musical Feldham Sings. That's all to come, but we begin the hour by finding the past really is a different country.
Why do you want to be a lobby boy?
Who wouldn't? At the Grand Budapest, sir.
And so my life began. Junior lobby boy in training under the strict command of Monsieur Gustave H. Many of the hotel's most valued and distinguished guests came for him.
I love you.
I love you. She was dynamite in the sack, by the way.
She was 84.
I've had older.
This was also when I met Agatha.
She's charming. She's so charming.
Is he flirting with you?
Yes.
I approve of this union.
I became his pupil, and he was to be my counselor and guardian.
The police are here. I want roadblocks at every junction for 50 kilometers. I want rail blocks at every train station for 100 kilometers.
Get in!
I want 50 men and 10 bloodhounds ready in 5 minutes.
Never knowingly a stranger to a flourish where a full stop might suffice, director Wes Anderson's rich style has delighted as many critics as it has pushed away. His last film, Moonrise Kingdom, seemed to loosen the reins a little, but his new movie, The Grand Budapest Hotel, is so designed, so clockwork, so perfect, that it wouldn't be a surprise if his hand occasionally entered the frame to poke the actors into the correct position. Designed by Anderson in cahoots with New York Times illustrator Hugo Guinness, The Grand Budapest Hotel is a succession of narrative layers that move rapidly backwards from almost the present day to the verge of the Second World War. Sitting atop a mountain in the fictional European kingdom of Zubroka, The Grand Budapest offers perfect rest and recuperation, watched over by the extraordinary head concierge, Mr. Gustav H., played by Ralph Fiennes as a gentle, bubbling mix of pernickety Leonard Rossiter and flirty Terry Thomas, Gustav keeps every whim of the guests satisfied. But when one of the elderly regulars, Tilda Swinton, as the wealthy and besotted Madame D, is found murdered, Gustav is the one and only suspect. He has no choice but to flee the hotel. His only companion, Zero, the lobby boy, he's taken under his wing. Emma, to start with you, I know everybody in the room has seen this, but Despite the co-story credit with Hugh Guinness, The Grand Budapest Hotel is the first film Anderson has written solely by himself. There's no Owen Wilson or no Noah Baumbach or Roman Coppola to dilute and filter Anderson's style. Is this unfiltered Anderson a good or a bad thing?
That is an interesting question. I hadn't thought about that because I did not enjoy this as much as other Wes Anderson films, in particular Fantastic Mr. Fox and Moonrise Kingdom. I remember reviewing Moonrise Kingdom here, which I just loved. So maybe, obviously, this being the next film on, it's kind of unfair. I'm like comparing Wes Anderson to Wes Anderson, which is still so much of a higher ballpark than
chocolate
so many other
chocolate.
Things. Yeah, kind of. But I felt emotionally removed again, which is a problem, I think, with Wes Anderson, and I like to be emotionally engaged, and Moonrise Kingdom managed that for me, but this time, and I don't know quite what it was. I don't know if it's a story. The design in this is amazing. I mean, incredible. It's awe-inspiring, the design visually, but there was just something about the story. Maybe it was a bit too frenetic. Maybe there was a bit too much going on. Maybe it was just there were times when there was, you know, Agatha, played by, I'm not even going to try and picture it, Charisse Ronan, who is the kind of pastry chef who's engaged to Zero. She Saoirse. Has a huge, what is it?
Saoirse,
lovely. Saoirse has this birthmark, which is just there for no apparent reason other than it's so Wes Anderson to have a huge birthmark. I don't know, there was just bits that were just a little bit too much for
it. It made her less perfect. They made a point of that she was so beautiful. But yeah, I agree with you that it was an over-design, but then it was there for more of a reason. It was a fly in the ointment. There's always flies in the ointment throughout this whole film.
And the only other thing I would say is as well that of course one of the big things about this film is it was Ralph Fiennes' performance. It is the centre of this film, and I think that it's interesting that really the three major parts in this, which is Ralph Fiennes, the young guy who plays Zero, and F. Murray Abraham, none of them are kind of part of Wes Anderson's usual coterie, who all kind of pop up in other appearances. And that was interesting because it was a very different experience. That made it kind of a different experience. The design's very similar, but those three major parts I haven't seen in any other Wes Anderson films, and I did. Ralph Fiennes was a revelation. He was a lot of fun. It's a great film. I feel like I'm picking part of a great film.
It's why we have the show. The show might as well be called Picking Movies. It was the second title. I was judging which one I thought would get us more laughs in 10 years' time. Bums on Seats is what I went with. Owen. A lot of talk, as there always is with Wes Anderson films, with each new one that he's moving on to new territory here, and there's been some talk of that here, but he's still dealing with the same concerns. The hotel is the same as... He shuts his characters into worlds where they're safe. The hotel in this, the tent that the children hide in Moonrise Kingdom, the Tenenbaum household, the underground treehouse in Fantastic Mr. Fox, he's working similar territory here.
Oh, definitely. I wouldn't say that this is sort of breaking new ground for Wes Anderson, really. I think... I agree to some extent that this is an incredibly controlled, very Wes Anderson-y world that he's created, and that could be inaccessible. I think that the absolute, different from his other films, I would say that the absolute unequivocal, genuine comedy of this breaks down that inaccessibility for me. I've liked most of the stuff that Anderson's done, but I found with this that there is just an outright comedic element that is genuinely laugh out loud funny. I think with most of his other films, they're amusing and they're offbeat and they're quirky, but they're not necessarily laugh out loud funny very much. Whereas this, there are moments in this, there is a moment in this where there is just a perfect comedy set piece where he's just, I won't spoil it, but he's just... You know, he interjects in a story where Ralph Fiennes' his character interjects in a story that the Zero character is telling, and it is perfect. And that, for me, made this as accessible as it needed to be. I also think that there's a sort of melancholy to Wes Anderson's films, which is always there. And I think a lot of people have said about this film that it sort of lets that go. I don't think it does at all. I think there's a sort of attitude to the passing of time and the kind of lost world thing, which is just... is beautiful and loaded with pathos and really, really quite beautiful.
That point to go to Sarah. It's melancholic and more melancholic than many audiences might be expecting by the presence of Bill Murray and Edward Norton on the poster. But it seems to be rather, and I think this is different from previous Anderson films, with the exception of maybe Moonrise Kingdom, is it's suspicious of that melancholy. It's suspicious for the reasons for it. The very nature of the narrative here in that that one character visits the, an author's grave, and reads his book about the Grand Budapest. We then go back in time, and then we go back in time. Everything's remembered through a filter. Nothing's genuine. We're forced to accept that these beautiful things pass, but at the same time, we've also have the inkling they never really existed, at least not in the form they're being presented to us.
Well, I think also as well that filter could kind of be seen as sort of a nostalgia too, so a sort of sentimentality, which, you know, I think basically for me, and this is a personal opinion, is that I don't know about Fantastic Mr. Fox because I missed that, but I'm going to say from Moonrise Kingdom onwards, he's evolving a heart. His films have always had a sort of sense of remove for me, always. But these last two, I've been able to connect in a way I've never have with his films before. And I say sentimentality, but I don't mean that as a negative thing. I think this is... I absolutely loved this film. I really did. And it is very precise and very structured, but... there's something different to that compared to, say, the Tenenbaums. And I think it's that sort of emotional centre.
Dave, bring you in here. I mean, I don't know how much of an Anderson aficionado you are, but...
not as much as an aficionado as the others. The thing I've always had about Wes Anderson films is that, for me, they've always been a very mellow, kind of laid-back experience. And I felt a noticeable difference in this one. It was, I'm going to say, pacier. And also, I think it was the cuts, the way that he'd done some of the cuts in this one compared to other ones that I noticed. There's, I'm going to call it the museum chase, which isn't a chase because it's done on foot and it's quite slow and cautious and clever. And in the end, it turns out one person isn't actually chasing the other. They're just kind of waiting craftily. And it was superbly done. There's a bit where, who's the character? Jeff Goldblum. He's running up the stairs, and you just have a shot, usually, of someone running up the stairs. But the way he cuts it, he's got three different shots of him running up the stairs. Same staircase. Looks perfect. And, yeah, that's pretty much all I can say on this, because everyone else has said everything else I want to say.
It's always the problem when the room's full of reviewers.
Yeah.
But does this extravagance of style, which has been... I personally don't have a problem with, and personally I've never felt removed from his films because I'm not looking for somebody to care about that way, in that way, and which is why I don't have a problem with Kubrick or Polanski or any of the filmmakers I'm told I'm supposed to have a problem with, because they don't care. The Coens, you know, I don't need them to care about their characters or not. But does the design get in the way of maybe some of the things he's trying to say? And I'm thinking in this case he does bring in fascism. This is a hotel in a part of Eastern Europe that he's invented. It's a conglomeration of movie world. There's references to Max Ophuls and Ernst Lubitsch and the Night Train to Munich and the cable car scene, and it's a movie Europe, but he brings fascism into it. And does that work?
I was going to say, actually, yeah, because the ending to this is probably darker than any other Wes Anderson film there's been, really, and not to go into too much detail, but I did find
Everybody dies.
I found that a little clunky, because I did find it, this whole kind of confection, it's all, you know, like I said, there's a lot of kind of visual reference of Mendel's cakes or whatever, and the whole thing looks like a doll's house and also like a kind of candy confection, if you will. And then this very, very black, dark... down ending, and I personally just found it a little clunky, because I was like, ha, 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 caper, some death, but always kind of in a comedic manner, and then bang, and maybe that's the point he's trying to make, bring that ending home to you, but it didn't quite work.
He's successfully, in my mind, making a point that we get to see when they introduce the idea that Tilda Swinton's character's been killed. He's shown a newspaper, and they all miss the headline of war is looming, and there's this idea that Europe was frivolous on the eve of war. But I don't think it needed to make more connections there. I haven't been able to quite think this out, but the design, I thought the design should perhaps work into fascism a little bit more,
because
fascism holds design at the core of its being.
Yeah, I think there's an interesting thing that I'm not absolutely... I mean, obviously it's set in a fictional country, but there's huge reference to Eastern Europe and those sorts of things. I'm not absolutely convinced that the kind of war that breaks out is necessarily a direct reference to the war, you know, the Second World War. I think
it's not the Second World War, it's Wes Anderson's Second World War.
Yeah, I realise that, but I'm not even sure that it's that. It feels more like some kind of sort of occupying sort of civil war to me, but that's beside the point. I actually really like the fact that at the end of this film, it all kind of it, like you say, sort of everyone dies kind of thing, because I felt like that is still referencing this idea of these beautifully constructed, elaborate confections, in that in the end there's kind of nothing there. We're not, like you said at the beginning, that we're not actually sure that any of this stuff is true. It doesn't, you know, there's no, although there's a lot of heart to the film, I don't think there's actually any sort of substance to these stories that are being told. They're so filtered through so many people that I'm not sure that there's any kind of reality there, and in the end we're just left with this kind of, oh, there's no satisfaction to this. And I really liked that about it. I thought it was really interesting.
That is such a common thing that's levelled at Wes Anderson, isn't it, that, you know, it's style over substance. I would say that if you love Wes Anderson, you're going to love this film. If you don't love Wes Anderson that much, I can't imagine you're going to be won over by this film.
I disagree. No, I disagree, because I am not a fan in the slightest. I have not liked anything he's done until Moonrise Kingdom, and I love.
But you haven't seen
film.
Fantastic Mr. Fox.
I love
it. I'm just going to leave it. So that would be 2 out of 5 films. So you're kind of leaning towards it, and if you see Fantastic Mr. Fox, you might be a 50-50 hit.
The world is split into two factions, no matter what the politicians tell you. It's those who don't like Fantastic Mr. Fox and those who do. And we will eventually drive the rest of you into the sea.
We're certainly not going to be allowed on this show if you don't like it.
No. Yeah.
That's why she's pretending she hasn't seen it.
Yes. Finally, to come back to you. No, I won't ask Sarah, because you haven't seen the bulk of his other films, but does anybody think that the cast gets in the way? That there are so many that eventually they just pop up in cameos. Oh, here's Bill Murray for a bit. Here's Bob Babylon.
No, I kind of liked it. You kind of feel you feel a sense of warmth, don't you, when you see Owen Wilson pop up for his minute? Sorry, Sarah.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, I got told I haven't seen the bulk of his films. I've only missed 2.
Well, I was just...
Sorry. I didn't say it.
Yes, but you've already mentioned that one of them was Fantastic. I've explained the situation. Live with it. Sorry, Owen. Yes.
Very quickly on the cast issue. I was going to mention this earlier. There's been a series of films of late where the main bulk of the advertising of the film has been the cast. I'm thinking of The Butler, that awful film, The Counselor, and this for me was the film where there was that interfered the least. The only exception, oddly for me, is Bill Murray, who I love, for me in this it never does. And I think it's because the world is so beautifully constructed that you don't bat an eyelid when these people turn up. It's not because they're in his other films, just because, oh, he's a weird, odd character. It doesn't take me out of it at all, which it has in everything else.
They also turn up in one very specific scene. I think a lot of those cameos are in one specific, very amusing scene. Actually, it was one of my favourite scenes in the whole film. Yeah. And they, you know, so it kind of fitted for me that he brought them in a kind of almost a separate scene for the rest of the film. I thought that was.
But doesn't it make you feel that we're not watching a film, we're just looking inside his brain?
No.
Yes.
And these are the numbskulls all moving around and moving the furniture. Does that not...
It's a heck of a brain to look inside.
Yes, but that's not such a bad thing to... You know, that's not necessarily a terrible thing, is it? I don't know.
Okay. All right. Films are a look inside a director's brain, surely.
I know, but some disguise it better than others. And it's the lack of that disguise and the frivolous nature of the inside of his brain.
I don't think Wes Anderson's ever been accused of a lack of artifice before.
No.
You know, if there's a lack of something in Wes Anderson, I think that's a good thing.
I'm looking forward to the film where it's released and the poster just says in quotes at the bottom, lack of artifice.
Yeah.
I like that. See this Wes Anderson film, there's a lack of artifice. Okay. Hotel, that's big thumbs up from some of us. Slightly.
Still a thumbs up.
Okay, all right. We'll move on, or we'll have 10 seconds for Under the Skin. Anyway, Hotel Grand Budapest opened last week and is screening at both the Arts Picture House and both Cambridge Multiplex Cinemas. It is a certificate 15 because it is surprisingly violent in a sort of symmetrical, well-ordered way. One of the successful stories of last year's 34th Cambridge Film Festival was a low-budget romantic comedy, Dead Cat, the feature film debut for director Stefan Giorgio. The Blackley comic story stars Sebastian Armesto as Michael, a mild-mannered man who suddenly finds himself face-to-face with his childhood sweetheart. What was a frivolous teenage romance suddenly takes a more serious and strange turn when played out by adults. However, despite its success at numerous film festivals, not just Cambridge, Dead Cat has struggled to find a proper release in a saturated distribution market. But this coming Thursday, March the 20th, does see the film return to the Arts Picture House along with an accompanying director's Q&A. But back during the Cambridge Film Festival, regular Bums on Seats host and reviewer Mark Livesich sat down with Stefan Giorgio to talk about his first feature, what had sparked the idea, how to film with a minimal budget in London, and how to make sure there was an all-important chemistry between his cast. But first, Mark asks Stefan why they had settled on the humorously grim title of Dead Cat.
Michael.
She was this girl, Kristen.
We grew up together. Childhood sweethearts, I guess. But I dumped her and I haven't seen her in 10 years.
What did you do when you saw her?
I once followed a girl halfway across London because she smelled like you.
What?
Doomed, mate. It's a
tricky really glad we bumped into each other.
We didn't bump into each other. You're following me. I don't know
where you're from. You've turned into quite the stalker, haven't you?
Listen, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to be weird. It was just that my cat died.
What was your cat's name?
It wasn't intended to be the title of the film. It was just a working title that just kind of stuck, really. You know, we challenged other people to come up with a better title, but nothing ever came that really fit the story that we were telling. And what happened was I certainly knew the first image of the film would be that of a dead cat, and we used it as a symbol, almost like a metaphor, for our protagonist Michael to sum up really where he was in his life. You know, he can't even look after his own cat, let alone do anything else. And that was kind of a good starting point, I felt, for his journey.
The romantic comedy drama genre, was there something that appealed to you particularly in that for your first film?
Yeah, I think when we knew that we were going to make a independent feature film, we discussed what genre we wanted to tell. And a lot of people obviously go and make horror movies as their first films for obvious reasons. Budgetary reasons obviously mean that you can shoot everything in one location, etc. But I felt that wouldn't have been us putting our best foot forward. You know, I wanted to tell quite an emotional story. Sam did too, who's the co-writer on the film. We wanted to tell a story about relationships in London, contemporary relationships. And that's what we set about doing.
How did you find it getting the balance between the different elements of the romance, the comedy, the drama? Is it something that you and Sam, as you were writing it, debated?
We wanted to execute a film that touched on all of those things. And it's one thing to write it. It's another thing to try and extract it when you're making the film. In the edit in particular, it's difficult. Myself and Steve Beard, the editor, you know, would spend a lot of time trying to, you know, pull the strings. How far can we go with this comedy here? How much can we push the romance? You know, do the audience at this point want these two people to be together at the end? You know, and it was very hard tonally to find a balance. And, you know, it was my first feature film. So I learnt a lot trying to find that balance. Hopefully we found it. Hopefully we found something that works for the film. But yeah, it was certainly a learning process trying to achieve those three things. I love those movies like your Jerry Maguire's, you know, those types of films where they do have the drama, they do have the comedy, and they also, you know, they're touching films because they talk about relationships as well.
It doesn't feel like a film that's specifically going after one particular demographic. It's something that will just have a broad appeal naturally.
The film is about people who are in their late 20s, early 30s, and so initially we thought that was the demographic that we were going to appeal to. However, the film is also, you know, it has a father-son story in there, and the film is also about that person who you had a relationship with when you were younger and that didn't work out, but you still kind of harbor feelings for that person. What happens if you re-meet that person later in life? And I think that, you know, those are themes that appeal to a lot of people. You know, a lot of people remember that first love. A lot of people have issues with their parents that they're trying to work out. These are themes that are universal. And so I think as we've tried to put the film out there at festivals, we're realizing that audiences of all ages are finding something in the film that they can relate to, which is a really great feeling. And I'm so glad that a lot of people are enjoying it.
And in terms of that tone as well, it's representative of the fact that your film is full of characters. You don't have the rough edges brushed away. They are real and human rather than being constructs of a script. Was it something you wanted to generally embody, a sort of certain Britishness?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a very huge intention on our part to tell a story about real people. You know, we often in the romantic kind of comedy genre, they're kind of caricatures almost of people. You know, there's not always necessarily people who you would see on the street. And we wanted our film to be a very London film, but a London not of Big Ben's and London Bridge, you know, a London that Londoners know. And I wanted the people in the film, the characters in the film, to be friends that people had known, not to be you know, your good-looking movie stars. That wasn't the intention. They all had to be very rough. You know, that their stories are stories that we all go through. Everyone's got an agenda in the film. Everyone has to go through their own journey.
What are the practical realities of making a contemporary London film in a setting like that with lots of night shoots and various other factors that you had to think about?
Very difficult. very difficult to make that. A lot of it is done with a lot of people giving their time and a lot of hard work and heart for very little reward. That's the truth. You know, you ask a lot of people to be part of your project and you try and engage them with the script and you try and give them promises of what you hope will the film would end up as. And we had that. We just kind of said, look, guys, you know, we think that you're talented. We love that you like the script. You could either be at home waiting for a project to come to you or you can come and be part of our project. And we were very honest about the limitations of our project. We were honest about the budget that we were working towards and that our film, a lot of it would be, you know, shot on the street, without permissions, you know, without many lights, if any. And so it was just kind of very much guerrilla filmmaking, trying to make that independent film. And, you know, people got into the spirit of making the film in that way, and that really helped.
And one of the keys to the film as well is the chemistry of the central cast, the four leads. How difficult was it to get that to work as well as it did?
You're right in saying that it was absolutely integral to get that right. And part of the process of getting it right was writing it for people. So we knew who the four people were going to be while we were writing it. And I think that really helped. They're all friends in real life, which is good, and helped us. Having that as having their friendship as a basis to start from, I think made a big difference to our film.
In terms of actually then taking the film out to market, it's very much been the film festival route for you so far.
Yeah, and that's a tough thing to do. You know, film festivals are layered in a certain way. You have the top tier of film festivals, your Cannes, your Berlin, your Venice, and then layer under that, layer under that, layer under that. And we've had to find, you know, whilst also being ambitious with the film, we've had to find where the film fits in that festival circuit. So we have tried to target festivals in the UK because obviously it's a very British film. Festivals in London in particular, because it was obviously set in London. But we're finding that the film is also having, you know, having success around the world. It's finding an audience. It's screening in Mexico this evening. It's also going to screen in the US at a couple of festivals in the coming month. So that's really great. We've sent it to Australia, so there's fingers crossed there. And we really hope that this film finds an audience.
The difficulty of you need money to make money, almost, that actually without some success behind you, without some cachet, actually then trying to get funding to complete the film, to try and get distribution, becomes more of a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, when you're making a film of this scale, for which is classically, it's called a no-budget film. It's not even a low-budget film. It's called a no-budget film. It's very difficult to obviously finish your film. We obviously tried to find some finishing money from the UK Film Council, as it was then, and they liked the film. They liked it, but for them, it didn't fit a certain remit. For whatever reason, they kind of felt that without the film having a sales agent or without the film already being accepted to a festival, they couldn't part with the money that we needed to finish it. There's a lot of filmmakers making no-budget films. And unless your film does hit one of those really good festivals or, you know, does get a sales agent very quickly, then they can't help you. And unfortunately, in this country, we kind of have to live with the reality that unless your film is that, you won't get support from the BFI Film Fund. I think as filmmakers, if you don't get that support from the BFI, then you just have to kind of suck it up and do the best you can with your film and get it out to as many film festivals as you can and try and push it as much as you can on social networking sites and try and find the audience. And, you know, hopefully that maybe the next film will fall into that remit. It's really tough, but I think it's character building as well. You know, how much do you want it? I'm a firm believer that, you know, if your film is good, it will find an audience somehow. It might not be the biggest audience it can find, but people will like it, they'll talk about it, and hopefully film festivals will screen it, and hopefully it will lead to making the next film.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Stefan Giorgio for finding time for an interview during his hectic schedule at last year's Cambridge Film Festival, and for the ever-reliable Mark Livesich for asking the questions.
As mentioned, Dead Cat has a special screening at the Arts Picture House on the 20th of March, this coming Thursday at 10 a.m. So something to enjoy with the Picture House's new breakfast menu. It is already half sold out. So if you're interested in going, try to book your tickets as quickly as possible, which of course you can always do by visiting the Picture House website or popping down in person.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city with me, Toby Miller, and in the studio are Emma Marchant, Sarah McIntosh, Dave Riley and Owen Baker. Don't forget that we're only at the beginning of the Cambridge 105 afternoon. After us at 1 p.m. is the music and conversation of Saturday lunch, whilst the latest bookmark barks at its heels from 2 p.m. On their show today, they have Cambridge crime writer Alison Bruce and poet Diane Brodie. Radio Dante, the show with everything Italian in Cambridge, follows at 3 p.m. with 105 Sport offering all the sport that's fit the sprint, as well as second half commentary of Cambridge United's game against Dartford. That's all to come today on Cambridge 105, but we've still got a busy half an hour of the show left. Still to come, we've an interview with documentary producer, editor and filmmaker Roger Grafe and a review of the divisive Under the Skin. But before that, we need to get in a hurry.
Boys,
we missed you, brother.
It's time to celebrate.
Call up some females. Do you know any pretty ones?
You like your mama?
What are you thinking, Toby?
This could put him away for life. It's time we make him pay. But first, we're gonna need a fast car.
Y'all ready?
I'm doing this.
Racing is an art. Revenge will surely come. But racing with passion, that's high art. And I think that's Toby Marshall driving the chariot of the gods.
I'm willing to give $6 million to anyone who puts a stop to him.
We'll settle this behind the wheel.
In these days, where the weirdly supermodel perfection of CGI has falsified every corner of cinema, the thrill of the old-fashioned car chase has been missed. Even the vehicular mayhem of the Fast and Furious films is now more a ballet of pixels than a careful professionalism of stunt drivers. Though apparently based on a computer game, new release Need for Speed has been taking great pride in the fact its car chases are genuine cars going genuinely fast. Aaron Paul, in his first leading man role since Breaking Bad made him a star, plays a racing driver with the badass name of Toby. The film finds him just released from a 2-year stretch in jail, framed by Dominic Cooper's nefarious luxury car dealer for a crime he didn't commit. Fueled by this injustice, Toby reforms his old crew and joins forces with Imogen Poots's unlikely petrol head in order to beat his enemy in a famous East Coast race. Because Toby knows this is the one score that needs to be... West Coast race. But Toby knows this needs to be one score that needs to... I got America messed up, you know. It's a big country. He knows this is one score that needs to be settled on an open road. They, obviously, we're going to be fairly... quick here, suitably. Need for Speed shouldn't have too much to do to entertain. It certainly has to get its actors from A to B in super quick time. Does it fulfil this requirement satisfactorily?
Of course it does. There are amazing cars and they're driving them quickly. More to the point, they don't go from A to B, they go from A to B to C to D, because there's actually two races, don't forget.
It would have been quicker if they'd just gone from A to B without taking the rest of the alphabet in.
You can't just go from A to B. You've got to go somewhere else after B. That's the point. We are talking about an adaptation from a video game here. There's a very short list of any that have been good. The first Resident Evil, all the rest after that, you can just kind of shuffle to the side and enjoy when you're drunk. First Mortal Kombat movie, just wish there'd never been a sequel. And you could argue the first Tomb Raider movie because Angelina Jolie is very pretty. But other than that, I mean, Need for Speed has skyrocketed to the top of the list for me. It was entertaining.
Just climb the one step.
The one step with all the others crowding and just, punching
just,
each other.
It's just yeah. Open the baby gate it's, on the
it's
croc.
Basically like a beat-em-up game, and it's punched all the others and just gone, I win. And, you know, you mentioned the lack of CGI, and for me that both kind of... It helped the movie, and at times it hindered it, because there's times where I thought, actually, if they could have just shot that with a bit of CGI, it would have been a nicer shot. and it annoyed me. But at the same time,
that's a remarkable thing to think in this day and age.
Quiet you. Having,
I'm just curious about what sort of shots you meant. I mean, obviously the
Some of the way the cars are taking the curves. It would have been better if
they'd been artificial.
I don't know if the way the camera had been able to move, like they've been able to do in the Fast and Furious films, because the camera itself is artificial and it can move through space that they can't take a real camera through because it's going to get run over. Things like that. Whereas in the Fast and Furious, they're able to shift the camera almost over and through a car while tracking another car.
So, in a way, you're sort of...
We're getting far too technical.
I'm not letting you get away with this, and not in Cambridge of all places. So you're complaining that there's too much physics in this film.
Yeah,
it's
sometimes.
It's too realistic.
Yeah. No. From the camera's point of... No, from where the camera is.
If the camera's fake, the cars would have been fake as well.
I don't
want
to kill a cameraman here.
Okay, all right.
It's just about positioning the camera. With CGI, you can actually put the camera wherever you want it.
Only because the environment's fake. So you're still asking for...
Sometimes you've got the real backdrop.
Let's skip everything else in the show. I want to get to the bottom of this.
I'll tell you after the show. Let's let Emma talk about Need for Speed.
Okay. I do feel we're getting away from, you know...
I know, I tell you all to speed up. And then
I am
the speed bumps of the programme.
I would not have gone to see this if I was not reviewing it today, and I ended up thoroughly enjoying my 2 hours. I can't explain what it was that I liked.
Lowered expectations?
That definitely helps, for sure. I've never seen... Well, no, I've had this discussion. I don't think I've seen a Fast and Furious film. I may have seen number one a long, long time ago. So forget the whole Fast and Furious thing, because I didn't go into it thinking about that. I guess I went in thinking, okay, so this is Breaking Bad's Jesse Pinkman's first kind of vehicle. Let's see how he stands up. I thought Aaron Paul was great. I thought Imogen Poots, who I haven't seen before, they're going to be in another film together.
Mm-hmm.
And adaptation. And I thought she was charming. So I like them, because the large portion of the film is them kind of having a comedic road trip. There's a bit of, you know, rom-com aspect in there for the ladies. Not really, that's very sexist. I mean, I'm joking. And most importantly, there is Sir Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton, yes, is all I have to say about this
Does
film.
Anybody think his plan? I mean, he's this sort of... he plays Monarch,
he's
who's
insane.
The over...
Well, he sits in an office by himself. He plays some guy who apparently made his money in the Industrial Revolution, apparently, someone says at one point, who organises this illegal street race, secret illegal street race. It's a bit like the old school raves or whatever, where you suddenly get a message telling you where you've got to meet and where it's going to be. But he just...
Well, then has it end at where he lives?
And also,
it's quite obvious he lives in a lighthouse. The end of the race is at a lighthouse.
When he gets to talking about it, but
his lighthouse.
I don't know. I think I said to someone on Twitter, he does manic energy like very few actors, and it made me realise how much I've missed Michael Keaton. So that could, you know, he has some bits in it, and that for me was worth the price of admission to Haverhill Cineworld, which I always try and plug because it's marvellously good value. And I was by myself in a massive cinema on a Friday lunchtime. I don't know. I couldn't ask for much more. It entertained. And I'm really surprised at the terrible reviews it's had, because I just think, as popcorn Friday night fare, you could do a lot worse.
If you just want to go out and watch a good movie and be entertained, this is really one of the movies for you.
It's not trying to be the next...
I don't know. Is there any good road movie?
What?
I need an example quickly, Toby. Just name one.
This film makes Smoking the Bandit look like Russian Ark. It's so poor. But we're not going to... I mean, there's a lot of other car films barking at the heels of this car film.
Damn boy.
I think it's a solid 3 stars.
Yeah, 3 stars.
I thought it was the Cannonball Run reenacted by Muppet Babies. That's what
I would
imagine
that too. You're selling me too. You've just sold it to everyone.
You will agree on one thing. You recommend it is sort of mindless Friday fare, which is fine. I'll recommend it just for Imogen Poots going scarier than bus, 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 which is a brilliant line.
Yes,
which she delivers in her usual odd intonation. She's a strange actress. I like her a lot.
And Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton, Imogen Poots. If they'd been in the film by themselves, maybe having a picnic, it would have been 5 stars. Okay, and we've got to move on. Need for Speed opened during the week and is screening at both View and Cineworld Multiplex cinemas. It is a Certificate 12A. It appears to be available in both 2D and a sort of tricksy 3D, so keep an eye.
3D, don't bother with the 3D. I had to see it for timing. Not worth it in the slightest.
No, I can't imagine. It would have been post-converted anyway. So, give that a miss.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105. Beep.
Last weekend, the rooms, corridors and lecture halls of the Divinity School of Cambridge's St John's College overflowed with new cinemas. The fifth Watersprite Cambridge International Student Film Festival took place. There was a strong documentary element to the festival this year with the visit from the hugely influential filmmaker Roger Grafe and a panel discussion about not only including Grafe and BAFTA-winning director Brian Woods, but also documentarians Penny Woolcock, Sasha Mirsoeff and Sarah Winfield. Bums on Seats recorded an interview with that panel, which will be running on a future show. But before that, I spoke to Roger Grafe about his long and vital career. After a lecture that had revealed the enormous variety of his work, from the cinema verite of Police and the fly on the wall closeness of Panorama and Dispatches episodes he's been involved with, to the groundbreaking musical The Feltham Sings back in 2002, it seemed best to ask him how he thought the audience for the documentary had changed.
You are about to witness the very exciting story of a city and its people. It will be an adventure that will open new sights in familiar surroundings.
I think what's interesting is that the tolerance of pauses at low level of events actually is a curious byproduct of things like Big Brother, where people are perfectly willing to see people just sit in the house for God knows how long, do precious little. People are willing to sit still and not have events kind of pile on top of each other the way, I don't know, in some of the satellite channels, Bravo and so on, and traffic cops, and those are real life condensed in a way that's parallel to the reality show, so-called reality shows. And I think, therefore, people's appetite for real people doing real things, unmanipulated, as in Kids in Care and Hold Me Tight, Let Me Go, and those Panorama films we make are documentaries. They're not current affairs. They're in a current affairs slot, but we film in exactly the usual way, unobtrusively, and not staging. So the point is that people have come full circle through that journey in which the production people didn't trust them and were always souping things up and manipulating them to wanting things that are not manipulated. And I'm very pleased about that.
Surprised to hear you say that, because I would have assumed it was the opposite. I would have assumed incorrectly that the modern documentary would be more interested in character than detail and nuance, but you're saying that's not quite the case.
I'm not saying that they're not interested in character. They absolutely are being character-led wherever possible. But once you've got characters, then how you deal with them is the next question. So, for example, we did a series in Iceland, the supermarket, last autumn, which was a huge success, driven by the chief executive, Malcolm Walker, who is a character larger than life. Right? But we filmed in the normal way, and they are three perfectly good documentaries in which quite a lot of the time he's not on camera. But he was a charismatic enough character to get us the commission and to be part of the success. But some of the other people are quite modest characters, including customers of the supermarket. And we just get close enough to them, and the kind of spirit of it is respectful. That's why I like Benefit Street. They're not all great characters, but the filmmakers respect them, even though they're poor and living in this kind of improvised way. And that's what I'm talking about.
You mentioned it towards the end of your talk that the longer you look at something, as long as you look closely enough, you can find a film, find a story, yes, and everything. When does that process begin? Obviously, you, as you said, you had an inclination with the malaria results. Oh, there's a story here. But how much research do you do going in to find a story, or how much of it is realized during the process, yes, or is it just balanced
throughout? It's all three things, actually, and that's one of the problems I have with the current regime. I like to say, as I'm doing right now, I've got access to several really important institutions, and give me enough money to either send a researcher or do myself, just to sit there and watch, and the story will come to me, as it were, as I suss what's going on and what is normal and what the challenges are. And what we do is we get access in principle and say what we want is a normal challenge, not an extreme challenge, but I don't want you to know yourselves what the outcome's going to be. So we need them to take a risk on us, and we need the broadcaster to take a risk that we will find this and it'll be interesting. And that's been harder and harder, because people want to know right from the beginning, oh, what are we going to see? And I say, well, I don't know yet. I haven't been in.
Could you tell me a little bit about the possible balancing act between being completely fair to the subjects and the film having an author's voice?
It depends. I mean, if you take Rupert Murray's film about the fishing scandal. Now, Rupert, that was a polemic, just like my Florence film, and it's absolutely clear what he thinks. And it was a labor of love, and it was really difficult to get made and shown. But it changed the way restaurants now put sourced, organically sourced, or, you know, line caught and all of that. So it was absolutely right that his voice is all over that film. Where it's not okay is if somebody's sending up the people that they film without the cooperation of the people in it.
What not social services?
On road.
What not
Melton scene? Yeah, hold it up, just ride your bang up, you know what I mean? Yeah, this is straight to you. Scene?
On road. What not a male role model?
Again, you mentioned in your talk that documentaries were becoming more democratic because obviously the materials to film are smaller, easier, cheaper, more obtainable. Is that the case with editing? Because obviously that's where the manipulation comes into documentary filmmaking. Is there a case that still the footage, everybody's involved in filming the footage, but it still goes away?
Sure, but it depends on the morality of the editor and the commissioning editor and the people involved. There are instances which I keep hearing about that commissioning editors say, you've got to soup it all up, you've got to do the kind of humiliation or the manipulation, which I absolutely resist. And when that happens, there's usually a row which we hear about. So it's not that it happens very casually, but I've heard too much about commissioning editors demanding that. So there is a pressure there, you're absolutely right. But what I meant was that, as in the footage that you're going to put on your website, there's guerrilla television, there's a whole bunch of Kickstarter and various other crowd-funded films, which are not manipulated, and where the, of course, any editing is manipulation, but if the people in the film feel comfortable about it, as we try and make sure that they are, then I think that's what you do when you make a film. You can't show everything, but the choice has to be one that's respectful to the people in it, accurate and interesting. Now, if you can square that circle, then you've got a film.
On road, what not a male role model? On road, what not a hot convertible? On road, what not social services?
On road,
what not business associates?
On road,
what not creepers and keys?
On road,
what not Mercs and Jeeps?
On road,
what not 60 a year?
On road.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Roger Gray for sitting down for the interview, and to Vanessa Lee and others at Water Sprite last weekend for making sure this interview and others we'll be broadcasting had time and space to happen. In the never-ending battle between the prestige and the kitchen sink, British cinema forgets it also has a knack for eerie science fiction, something brought into sharp and strange focus by new release Under the Skin. Though an adaptation of the novel by Michelle Faber, the film is very much the work of its director Jonathan Glazer, whose two previous films, Sexy Beast and The Underappreciated and Underseen Birth, have both shown a remarkable eye for the unusual in the everyday. Scarlett Johansson, acting both within her type and well outside her comfort zone, plays an unnamed extraterrestrial who's taken alluring human form in order to steal men from the streets of Glasgow. She hooks up with the lonely or the desperate, lets her idiot lust drag them into a rundown council house, and there they are consumed by a terrifying alien technology. She then silently redresses herself and is cast back out onto the streets to hook another unfortunate soul.
No. So you live alone?
Yes.
You think I'm pretty?
I like her gorgeous.
Come to me.
Oh, and Under the Skin has won over critics both here and in America with its unusual blend of harsh, sort of Ken Loach types realism and cinema verite realism and poetic, visually stunning, striking science fiction. Did it leave a lasting impression on you, that mix?
Oh, I think definitely. I suspect that impression will last and to some extent increase over time. I know that some people who've read the book have not been keen, and I can sort of understand that. I haven't read the book myself, but the there are things about this that are stunning. I saw in the, I think it was the trailer for it actually, that he's been compared, you know, an heir to Kubrick. There are obvious reasons for that when you see the film. I'm not completely convinced by that. I think whilst this is absolutely the director's film, I think Scarlett Johansson is extraordinary in it. I think, you know, it, obviously he will get a lot, the director will get a lot of the plaudits because it is such a director's film, and it is so visually arresting, and there are a lot of things to like about that side of it. But I came out of it feeling if anyone else had played the Scarlett Johansson role, it would have been a very different film, and I think probably a great deal less successful. It is an extraordinary performance by her. And the themes and of sort of alienation and the idea that we're all individuals and these connections with humanity are extraordinary. I really quite liked it. I'm not saying loved because I'm not convinced.
I really, really sort of want to marry you.
Yeah,
so that's what you did there.
Yeah. Always undercut it.
Well, you did the opposite of Australian. You ended on a downer.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Sarah, it's a simple plot. She lures the men. We see how the men are dealt with. She goes back out, and this continues in a deliberately repetitive fashion with a little bit more information revealed each time for at least the first half of the film.
Yep.
So plot-wise, it's simple, but thematically, it's a dreadful word to use, but there's a lot going on under the surface, which is suitable considering the film's visuals. There's an awful lot about male gaze and how women are depicted in film, how women and men relate to each other, how it's absolutely fascinating, very, very, very interesting.
Yeah, no, it was really interesting. I mean, usually if you had a predatory female like this, well, it's arguable as to whether she does get punished or not for that, but usually, you know, a predatory female in any Hollywood film is punished. They're put back in their place. But in this, I didn't feel that way completely about this film. And also, whether or not it takes... I mean, yes, it's not the typical male gaze.
Though it's the male gaze that she relies on, her Samantha's her character, and her, I'm presuming she's playing the same character. Her character relies on to lure men to their doom. It's this unquestioning, convenient lust. I think the film relies on it because she relies on it.
Yeah.
But it turns out on it interestingly turns out on the head because she's the predator, but then she becomes, but the people she's preying on, the men she's preying on, all the men in the film, give or take a few small examples, are not particularly shining examples. They're not villains, with the exception of one character towards the end, but they're not villains. They're just seem to assume a lot. They assume sex very, very easily.
Yeah.
I know she's flirtatious, but there's no questioning.
I think, you know,
And obviously that's not a reason. Flirtatious is not going to be careful here.
Any film about aliens, in some small way, depending on what film, is going to be about sort of an existential... it's going to be an existential film. It's going to be about looking at what makes us who we are, what makes us human. As has been said about, you know, there's this alienation thing as well, the alien and the alienation. And I don't know what I'm trying to say here, but it is very, very layered. There is a lot going on. And to be honest, I think the reason I'm having trouble articulating is because I'm still processing it. I only saw this last night. I came out feeling, you know, really positive about it. I mean, well, not positive as in the subject matter, but really having thought this was an amazing experience that I've just been through. But I think that that's, as I think Owen said as well, this is something that's going to increase the more and more you think about it afterwards. This is a film that stays with you for a very long time, and your opinions will either develop or change, or change several times.
It's the poets. One of the things that a poet does is obviously they frame the real world in such a way that you see it anew. He's very much, or rather, her character allows Glazer to do that. And just taking the idea of empathy, there are two scenes in this film. One, the beach scene, which we won't go into detail with, which I know you had struggle with, Owen, and I could have turned away from that scene quite easily. It's horrific without any gore. Just simply, I think it's one of the worst scenes, one of the most horrific scenes I've seen since doing this show.
Yeah.
But her lack of empathy in that moment, her character's lack of empathy, leads to the scene with the disfigured man she picks up in the van. Her flirtation with a man that who can't believe he's being flirted with because he's so disfigured. It's the same lack of understanding leads to both. I found that fascinating because yes. One illustrate one through light on the other.
Yeah, I want to put a slight. I'm about to criticise this film a bit, and I sort of don't want to because I wouldn't for a second want to put people off going to see it. I think if you think you might be vaguely interested by it, you should definitely go and see it. I did have a couple of kind of issues with it, which really only came in afterwards. But there is this disfigured character later on, which is very much a turning point in the film for her relationship.
Though not the fact he's disfigured.
No, not at all. I don't think it's fair to say there's no role. I think there is
her change in personality has nothing to do with his disfigurement. I think
because
she never realizes she doesn't know.
I think when she sees herself in the mirror, I think at least with the audience, we are asked to make a connection between the idea of what humanity looks like to us and what humanity is, or make a judgment about that, which is certainly reinforced by the fact that he doesn't look human. I mean, he's not just disfigured; he's got elephantitis or something along those lines, and he's hugely disfigured. He looks almost unhuman. And I had not an issue with that character. I actually think it's comfortably the nicest character in the film, actually. I think he's a really quite an interesting character. But I did have a slight issue with this kind of this idea that she's not bothered by it.
She doesn't notice.
Well, you say that, but she does reference his hands quite a lot.
I think that's just programmed flirtation.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because I think she's doing it in reaction to his face.
Okay.
She said about a couple of the other male characters that they're pretty or they've got nice smiles or they're handsome, and she doesn't say that to him. She talks about his hands. I think she is aware of his being disfigured or ugly or whatever you want to call it. And I felt like could be accused of being slightly hackneyed. I think in general the film is really, really interesting. I just am not entirely sure that it's quite as utterly unjudgmental of things as it would like us to believe. Having said that, do go and see it. It's really, really interesting. And there is some astonishing shots of the rural Scotland, which are just, they're at the same time beautiful and incredibly sort of almost frightening. And there's some really amazing stuff in this film. But I'm not sure I think about it more, I'm not sure it'll be utterly without me questioning it. I think there are things that aren't quite right about it.
We've got about 30 seconds. So Sarah, the sound mix, Owen pointed out the photography there. The level of craftsmanship here that Wes Anderson would be pleased about. The sound mix alone is tremendous. How she hears the world. That we don't realise how... The fact that they're in such an area of Scotland that almost all the English is unintelligible to our ears.
Mm.
And she's the only one who speaks recognisable English.
Yeah. No, the sound is really amazing. The music, the soundtrack, it's very rare that you even notice it in a lot of films. I don't think I've noticed it since that, I can't even remember the title, but the tsunami film with...
The Impossible.
Yeah. This is the first time where I've really been drawn and sort of aware of just how well crafted it really is.
Okay, we'll have to wrap up there. Under the Skin, which is excellent, not Kubrickian, that keeps getting overused, but it's very, very good. It opened yesterday, Friday the 14th, is that right? It's Friday the 15th today. Mm-hmm. Friday the 14th at the Arts Picture House. It is rated 15, but it is far more disturbing than that rating allows. Then that is all we have time for on the show today. The last hour will be shortly wrapped up in a neat podcast package and released both via the Cambridge 105 website and our page on iTunes. Remember, you can find us on iTunes, Twitter and Facebook if you simply search for Bums on Seats. So why not follow, like or subscribe to us? We demand it. We'll be back with an all new show on March the 29th with first of the summer blockbusters. The sun's just out and here they come. Captain America, The Winter Soldier. We've got Labor Day, the new film from the director of A Separation, and possibly Muppets Most Wanted, and another interview from Water Sprite. A lot of fist pumping with Muppets there. You are all grown-ups. We'll play out with some of the excellent... I love the Muppets. We'll play out with some of the excellent score to 1966 Daisies, a surreal masterpiece of the Czech New Wave, directed by Vera
Nikita Shalova, who sadly died earlier this week. Many thanks for listening. Please stay tuned for Saturday Lunch, but from all of us here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.